Hello, I'm Rick Brumbeck, and once again, welcome to our class here at the Henderson Church of Christ. You see the screen and the words there, carpe diem. You may already know what those words mean. They are a part of our common discussions and conversation, maybe one of the most recognized of all Latin phrases. The first use of it that we point to, going back really to the century, the decades right before Christ, is the use of this phrase by the Roman poet named Horace. In fact, Horace, who lived again about the same time as Herod the Great, Horace wrote in Ode Number 1, "Seize the day, trust very little in tomorrow." And that use of the words there, "seize the day," is the first occurrence in literature of carpe diem. There is some discussion about the word carpe in the use of translation sees, because the word carpe is a command, and the basic idea is to pluck or to grab hold of, right? So maybe some other words we could use in English would be like harvest or use or pluck the day. With this phrasing at the end of this part of Ode Number 1, what Horace is really doing is saying, let's not just put all of our confidence in the future and the things that will happen then. What he's encouraging is use the day, today, harvest today, pluck up the things that need our attention or that we find enjoyment in today. So in that sense, we're grabbing hold of the moment and not procrastinating. You may recognize the screen from the Dead Poets Society, a movie that came out in 1989. It featured Robin Williams in the role of John Keating, the professor or teacher for these boys. Well, the most famous line from this movie is a line that uses carpe diem. When the character of John Keating says, "Carpe diem, seize the day, boys, make your lives extraordinary." With those words, the character is encouraging the boys to not let moments pass by unutilized. Instead, take action right now to do things that benefit, that bless, that lay the foundation for good things that are in the future, yet to come. Carpe diem. You may look at this figure and think, or this image and think, wow, an ant, and that's the right moment to call an exterminator, right? But it also is a good image to call to our mind a fact that the Bible very often uses elements of the natural world to teach principles and to encourage a certain perspective that leads us to a good behavior. And the ant is just such a figure. Solomon would write in Proverbs chapter 6, verses 6 through 8, "Go to the ant, O sluggard, consider her ways and be wise. Without having any chief, officer, or ruler, she prepares her bread in summer and gathers her food in harvest." Now, simply put, what Solomon is saying is, consider the ant. Go to it, watch this animal, and think about, or this insect, and notice this ant is going to behave in a way that meets the needs of today and prepares for the future, doesn't have a chief, an officer, or a ruler. In other words, the ant doesn't require someone to look over the shoulder and make sure that they are behaving in a mature fashion. It's not necessary. And when Solomon says, "O sluggard," he's really speaking to the person who is lazy or indolent or just not very forward-thinking, and as a result, is not taking action that really should be undertaken. This is Solomon's way of saying that we ought to seize the moments of today to meet the needs of not only today, but preparing for the time that is ahead, however much that may be. It's a similar idea as what he says in Proverbs 10, verse 5. "He who gathers in summer is a prudent or wise son, but he who sleeps in harvest is a son who brings shame." Solomon, what do you mean by this phrasing? Well, Solomon is intending to say that a person who will get up and get things done when the opportunity is in front of us, when the need is there, is a person who's behaving in a very wise and commendable fashion. The person who neglects opportunities, the person who procrastinates or squanders time and opportunity, is a person who's ultimately going to be embarrassed disappointed. This may be really the person who says, boy, I wish that I could go back. I would get started sooner. I wish that I could go back. I would take that opportunity and not let it slide on by without having acted. That's the very thing that Solomon is trying to encourage. And it fits the idea of the phrase carpe diem. There are several ways that I would encourage us to be able to use the time that we have, whether great or small. The things that I mentioned are particular in some ways to this particular point in the school year or the year, but it's not limited by that. For example, I would encourage us to plan our needs and to have a long view, a bird's eye perspective where we see the whole, if you will. Think about somebody with a calendar who sits down and says, I have short-term goals, I have intermediate-term goals, and I have long-term goals. And I'm not going to wait until tomorrow to try to start using time and opportunities to work towards those goals being achieved or met. I'm going to start now. I'm going to use the time that I have today because today will be in the rearview mirror tomorrow, and I won't have any more access to it. I need to make sure that I utilize it in the best way possible. Now, these may be goals of various kinds. They could be academic and intellectual goals. They might be goals that are emotional in nature or relationship in nature, spiritual, certainly, in nature. But to have the short-term goals that I'm going to try to work on today and in the next few weeks and months, intermediate-type goals, the larger things I'm working toward in the next year or year and a half. And the longer-term goals are the ones that I'm going to do that look multiple years out if I'm permitted to live that long. But it's good for us to stop and think that I need to redeem the time that I have today. And a part of that is looking to see what is it that I should be pursuing that is worthwhile. In addition, I would say right now we can effectively use our time by making sure that we finish our semester and our studies well. This next few weeks, we're going to be wrapping up our various academic responsibilities, from papers to tests to homework. I really encourage you to put a smile on your face, to enjoy the fact that you have this time and opportunity to pursue these goals, and wrap things up well. And when you get done with the semester, you're going to be able to enjoy the satisfaction that comes with having put your best efforts forward and then reaping the benefits of that. That's a lot of what Solomon was talking about back in the book of Proverbs. So, finish your studies well. Make sure that you're very attentive. Put other things off, if you will, the recreation or other pursuits like that. Put those off until you wrap this semester up well, and then be able to move on with a sense of peace and satisfaction. Number three, I would really encourage you to give some time to tending to things that might have been put on the back burner for a while. You know, we talk about that back burner item. There may be books. Somebody says, have you read this book? Well, no, not yet. I'm intending to. It's just on the back burner. And what that means typically is that I have some responsibilities I need to meet right now, and those are not negotiable. I've got to meet those. But once those are out of the way, then I'm going to go ahead and I'll move to some of these other items. Well, how about right now we recognize the world's routines have been interrupted. That's true right now. And what that may mean is that you have a little bit more time at hand, a bit more discretionary time. You're wrapping up maybe the semester, and you're going to have some opportunities to tend to some things that you've put on the back burner for a little while. They could be things that are intellectual, emotional, relational, spiritual of nature. But I would encourage you to be very intentional about trying to say, I'm not going to let this time pass away unused. I'm going to use it in a very constructive way. Look at some things that you've had to put off for a while and think, am I coming upon a time where I can and I really want to put my energy, my efforts there? And then I encourage you to do so. Number four, I encourage us to think about relationships and priorities. Now, I don't know how many of you may have made a last will and testament already. Realize that if you're among the younger viewers for this class, you may think that this is not something that's particularly important for you at this point in your life, but I would urge you to perhaps reconsider that. Number one, your last will and testament is your way to have final say-so over any of the things or matters that are under your authority. And if you have some things, if you have matters that you are responsible for, it may be the last will and testament is very much appropriate for you and in your adult stage of life. But here's another reason why I would say that it's valuable, not just for persons who are later in their lifespan. One time I had a chance to speak to a number of people about making a last will and testament. And in preparation for that discussion, I had looked through a number of resources and came across a particular book that was put out by an attorney's office. A group of lawyers sat down, wrote out some very helpful material, and published a book about making a will. Now, you would expect that they would say, here are the mechanics, how you go about that process. Great. You might suspect they included the maybe some legal elements that talk about how the process is going to be managed should someone pass away and the will is executed. That's great. But what I was surprised to find in this book were a number of really insightful reflection instructions or observations. Like, they talked about the fact that when we sit down and we make a will, what we're doing is we're, if we do it right, we're inventorying our lives up to this point. Where have I lived and what have I done? What have been the achievements that I've been a part of or the pursuits that I have chased after? In that type of self-reflection or inventory, they said there are a number of things that come out. For example, they said in an inventory like this, and we think about maybe heirs or those who would inherit, it's also a very good time to think about the relationships that exist in our lives. Maybe there's someone that we have disagreements with, and we have burned bridges with them. Our relationship is not as good as it once may have been. And the advice in this book was, what a great time to see to rectifying that situation. What a great time to try and build bridges and reach out to other people and to make our relationships better and healthier and stronger. And their point was that if we prepare for our last will and testament, that kind of mental inventory can be bringing to our minds the situations like these that we really ought to address. Perhaps there's someone that we love and appreciate, and we realize that even though we have a great relationship, maybe we haven't told them recently. Or maybe we need to touch base and check on them, or just reconnect, even if there are no difficulties or problems. Doing a process like this can really help a person identify, there are some people I really want to touch base with, I really want to reconnect with. So relationships can be affected. The other thing that is mentioned, of course, in making a last will and testament has to do with, of course, the possessions that we have and how they're going to be disposed of should we pass away. Well, another helpful insight that this book provided was this. They said it may be that in cataloging our various possessions that we realize that in the past some things that we thought, I can't live without that, doesn't mean nearly that much, if anything at all, to us today. And it can remind us that life is not about things. Maybe we recognize that what I felt was so important to get or to have in years past is not at all what I thought it would be. Maybe I find out that it didn't bring me nearly the satisfaction that I had anticipated. So this book's instructions or guidelines really helped with the idea of taking an inventory of things, including the value of things, or maybe the lack of value of a certain thing. Now, I think about that, and you may be wondering, why are you including this in a discussion of Carpe Diem? But here's the answer. The Bible talks a great deal about making sure that we try to have good relationships, not only with God, but with other people, Christians and non-Christians. For example, this statement from Romans chapter 12 in verse 18, where Paul says, if possible, so far as it depends upon you, live peaceably with all people. Maybe there is somebody that we don't have a good relationship, but I would want that to be in spite of the fact that I'm trying to build bridges or have a good relationship, in spite of my best efforts, not because I'm being insensitive or dismissive. Maybe there's a person that I haven't touched base with in a while, or I need to tell them that I love them and I appreciate them, I want to live peaceably with all people. Jesus would say in Matthew chapter 5 with the Beatitudes, you know, blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called the sons of God. And I think about who said that. It was the very Son of God, Jesus, who helped make peace between people and between people in heaven. So it's important for us to attend to the relationships that we have both with God and with people around us in our lives. And this is a time right now where perhaps we can use that time, seize today, to do some of the things that we've been discussing. I can use today to help mend bridges or mend broken bridges. I can try to connect with people that I need to connect with. I can encourage those who really need to hear from me. I can tell those whom I love that I love them and be an encouragement to them. As far as the material aspects or the possessions aspect, I remember once again the words of Jesus that came this time from Luke chapter 12. Now, the words that he has here, take care and be on your guard against all covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. What I find ironic in this lesson we have is that Jesus spoke those words to a person who was concerned about inheritance. In this quote, verse number 15, that word covetousness, it simply is a word that means wanting something so much that it's really all we can think about. It's the driving or motivating force. I can remember being a kid and just having my eye on something, I don't know, a toy, whatever it was, and just, I couldn't get it out of my mind, and I would try to pester even my parents or others, I want, I want, I want. Well, we don't want to be that way, not as a child, but certainly not as adults. We need to be able to see what really matters. Things sometimes, they do matter, but they're not our God, and they shouldn't drive our lives in the way that God and the highest principles should. And that's really what Jesus is bringing out. Your life is not measured by the number of toys that you have. Our lives are not measured, even as we get into our later adult years and we're working and we're saving. Our lives are not measured by the size of our accounts, or the number of things that we have or can enjoy with other people. Those are nice, but they're not our gods. And so Jesus' words are about remembering that. Now, in the context for this particular statement, as I mentioned, a person came to Jesus and said, Master, I want you to speak to my brother as we divide the inheritance. Jesus asked him, said, well, you know, who am I to step in and serve as a judge in this matter? I don't even know you, right? But before going on, he did give this answer, and he cautioned this person, and really all of us, to recognize that while things are nice and things can be helpful or even necessary, they need to be balanced in our lives with other priorities as well. It's just following this that Jesus told the parable of the man who was so successful as a farmer that he had had to tear down his barns and build bigger ones because the harvest was so good, and he was so productive. The problem is, as Jesus told in this parable or story, this man suddenly died. And in his spiritual life, he was not rich at all. In his spiritual life, he was a pauper. So on earth, with physical things, he was wealthy, wealthy, wealthy. But then he left that life, as we all will at some point. And in the things that really endure and that really matter, who we are and who we are in relation to heaven, our spiritual life, Jesus said that man was totally impoverished. He was destitute. And that affected his eternity. So this is Jesus asking people to place a proper valuation upon things and possessions. Now that can happen when someone is putting together a will, as we mentioned. But it doesn't take an event like that. It may be that we sit down and we seize today to try and look back and reflect helpfully upon what it is that matters. We are grateful for our homes. We are grateful for food. We're grateful for our cars or things that we need to live. But in the end, we recognize they're still transient. And we need to make sure that they don't loom so large that we don't pay attention to things that are even more important. Who we are as a person, the way we carry or conduct ourselves in life, and how we relate to the people around us and to our God above. So, we want to make sure that we have right priorities. Let's make sure that we take the time to think about relationships and the way that we prioritize things in our lives. The next thing I want to mention, of course, I've hinted at already, is drawing close to God. It's important that we stay close to God at all times. You may recognize this image, perhaps some of you may remember when this event occurred, September the 11th, 2001. Or if not, maybe you've seen the images and some of the media. This is when the World Trade Center towers in New York City were bombed by airplanes. Flew right into the side of the buildings, and both of those buildings were destroyed. They collapsed to the ground, and so many thousands of people lost their lives. When that happened on September the 11th, studies show, there's no question about it, that church attendance and participation mushroomed, it skyrocketed after September the 11th. That calamity, that disaster that was inflicted by other persons, it caused people to stop and think about mortality. It caused people to think about their spiritual lives and what eternity might hold. And so religious expression and involvement really, it rose significantly right after this event. Or maybe you think about some of the natural disasters that people unfortunately suffer, like a tornado tearing through a neighborhood or a community, tearing through lives. No one appreciates or wants those kinds of things to happen, of course. But who are we in light of those? And oftentimes, after such crises, there's a real rise in concern for spiritual things in people's lives. I'm sorry for the crises that occur. I am always glad when people look toward God. If you think about events like this, someone once said, it's very easy to look up to God when life has knocked us flat on our backs. I think there's real truth to that. When calamities like these occur, people begin to think about spiritual things. The challenge is making sure that it's not only in the midst of calamity that we draw near to God. He needs to be at the center of our lives at all times, irrespective of what it is that is going on around us. In fact, God in the center of our lives makes the wonderful times even better and makes the terrible times manageable. There's a reason why James, the half-brother of Jesus, simply said, draw near to God and he will draw near to you. If I'm going to seize today and make sure that I get every possible advantage out of the time that right now affords me, it may be some things academic, it may be some things in my work, it may be some things even in my relationships with other people, but it has got to include, I've got to be close to my Creator. In Ecclesiastes chapter 12, in verse 1, Solomon said, to remember your Creator in the days of your youth. And then he goes on to say, we're going to grow older and older, and opportunities are going to pass. There will be things that we're no longer capable of doing. Maybe a moment that we had has gone by and it's passed forever and we can't seize that moment now. Well, we want to make sure that from the very youngest age, we draw near to God and hold on to our Creator and sustain that all of our lives. It's got to be essential to our identity as breathing, as eating, as thinking. Because those are a part of just existing. And so it has to be with God. I'm going to exist with God at my core because that's just who I am. Everything else, the ups and the downs of life. But at my core, I breathe to live. I center God in my heart to live. And I live with Him in mind. That's really what James is talking about. And we want to make sure that we seize the times of today forward to make sure that that is our highest priority. You may recognize this, YOLO, you only live once. Sometimes I think when persons say that, maybe what they're saying is, you only go around one time in life, so you better grab life by the horns. Maybe even being a little edgy or a little risky. Because this is your only shot. Go for it. Well, that's fine, but there's another way to look at YOLO too, and it's this. You only get this life to make good choices. You only get this life to be the character person that God wants you to be and you want to be. And as these days pass by, we look back, will I be happy upon who I was, or will I look back with regrets? And the only way to make sure that I can look back with satisfaction is to seize today and these moments to draw near to God and to be His person. He'll help me make sure I'm successful in all the other important areas of life. So, YOLO may even capture that sense of carpe diem, but with the idea that I want to make sure that today I achieve things that matter. Solomon would write it this way in Ecclesiastes chapter 9 and verse 10. He says, "Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might, for there is no work or thought or knowledge or wisdom in Sheol to which you are going." Now, Sheol is the grave world, right? So he's talking about after we pass away. Oh, we're going to know who we are, and we'll know about heaven and so forth. But what he's saying is, you're not going to go to your job once you've passed away. You're not going to continue your studies in a particular major or discipline. You're not going to continue to pull people and try to gain or garner wisdom from those who are around you. I mean, those processes, those describe life here, not life in the afterlife. And so he says, use today to achieve things that matter. That's the essence of carpe diem. Seize the day. May God bless you as you live in an intentional way, striving to make sure that you plan for all of the things that are important as best you can, that you take the opportunities when presented even to do some things that were unanticipated or unexpected. Make sure that you close out your responsibility sets successfully, whether in school or work or relationships or certainly spiritual things. Make sure that you value the most important things and prioritize in a way that God would approve of. And make sure that from this moment forward, you're always walking with Him, making sure that the time has been redeemed to its fullest. May God bless you as you seize the day.